Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the totally analog podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on November 11th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, Indiana. My co-host is
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we welcome back Brietta Clark. Professor Clark is on the faculty at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. She's an expert on healthcare law and inequality, and recently has specialized in the impact of the Affordable Care Act on Medicaid and private insurance. Big welcome back, Bri.
Thank you so much.
All right. So before we tackle Medicaid, there are a few things lying on my desk, and I think, Frank, you had some of the same list that I thought I'd try and move off it and get your views. First, into an issue that is of quite strong practical importance, the use of arbitration as an alternative to litigation with regard to personal injuries, particularly in the case of nursing homes. And there's an interesting new case out of Kentucky. It's called Extendicare Homes against Wisman, in which the Supreme Court of Kentucky held that arbitration would not be compelled in wrongful death cases by residents or deceased residents' powers of attorney unless the POA explicitly granted authority to waive a resident's constitutional rights with regard to trial and so on. And I thought that case was well worth highlighting given the recent excellent series by the New York Times on arbitration. And also, there's a fairly recent CMS NPRM on nursing home regulations. And CMS are looking like they're going for sort of transparency with regard to arbitration clauses rather than an outright ban, but they are asking that question. And I wondered, Frank, whether you had any thoughts about, I know you read that New York Times series and thought it was a pretty decent one.
I did, and I'm so glad you brought up the topic of arbitration, Nick, because I think this is an area where there was some incredible reporting, actually again in the New York Times from about 8 years ago. I'll put it up on the show notes page, on some of the more abstruse Byzantine strategies of private equity firms and other for-profit owners of nursing homes to deflect liability. And at the time, the deflection du jour was trying to characterize the ultimate owners as merely owning the land underneath the facility. And of course, you know, for anyone that teaches health law, you know, all those great cases about apparent and implied authority and indirect liability, et cetera, and the struggles in cases like Burless over deflection of liability strategies. And now we're seeing this in the arbitration context, a way to radically limit the consequences of, say, negligent or otherwise improper care, improper staffing, cutting staffing in ways that ultimately harms residents of the homes. And I am glad to see that CMS is trying to intervene here, but I really doubt that transparency is a solution. I think that in many of these cases, you really have situations where, I mean, we're all familiar with the classic depiction of the nursing home scenario where a family is in stress. They have to make very difficult important decisions in a very short period of time. And I would hope that the ultimate policy direction here is toward a much more restriction of these types of clauses, because there's just very little hope for, I think, a strong response to claims of neglect without that.
Right. So moving on to slightly different type of issue. We've talked here several times about the FTC's victory before the Supreme Court in the North Carolina teeth whitening case. I never get bored saying that. The agency has now issued a staff guidance on, quote, active supervision of state regulatory boards controlled by active market participants, which was the sort of the formula that the Supremes used in holding inapplicable the state antitrust immunity rule. The guidance is notably fact intensive. It struck me as having very, very few bright lines. Very much sort of in the mold of recent sort of FTC developments of sort of, as Dan Solov and others have called, sort of the common law that the FTC is working on in various areas. So not something to go into any detail here, but I do think it's mandatory reading for anyone dealing with state licensure or discipline or anything that touches on that.
Totally agreed, Nick. And I remember back our conversation with Bill Sage, maybe it was episode 10 or 11 or so, where we got into some pretty good discussions of the North Carolina dental case. And I agree with you. I mean, looking through the language of the FTC guidance here, I do see perhaps a field day for opportunistic claims of antitrust violations by boards when they're disciplining providers. And of course, you know, maybe there's going to be some situations that we're going to see where the boards were abusive and where what they tried to characterize as everyday supervision of the profession was in fact economic harm to competitors dominating the boards. But I do have to worry about the administrability here just along the lines that Justice Alito did in the teeth whitening case.
So finally, the new case that the Supreme Court has granted cert in, I'm sure, will be the subject of a full show or two here at some point. But as you both know, the court did grant cert in the 7 RFRA contraception cases over the last week. I'm going to restrict myself to just one question, and maybe you'll just leave it hanging there when I throw it out. On this issue, the circuits were pretty much in agreement on this one, about the reasonableness of the administration's accommodation after, you know, a couple of the speed bumps and the Hobby Lobby case and so on. So I guess my question is sort of a meta one. Is this the Supremes taking a case to draw a line under this objection and say, get back to work, everyone? Or does the religious spin in this case, the culture wars spin in this case, give the conservative wing of the court a real opportunity to claw back a win after 2 bad ACA defeats?
I like that analysis, Nick. It is hard to read the tea leaves. I find myself reading Marty Letterman's posts at Balkanization quite frequently to see the exact twists and turns of this doctrine. So I think your guess is as good as mine here, but I will be watching carefully to see if there's something really substantive here or if it's just sort of a symbolic shifting of the burdens of paperwork to one side or the other.
I'm always hesitant to try to predict anything that the Supreme Court plans to do, especially since I've been wrong so often. But I really do hope that, you know, this is going to be an opportunity to draw a clear line between kind of what is viewed as a reasonable accommodation and what is actually enabling something that's more obstructionist in nature. And this is really critical for access to healthcare.
Let's now turn to some real substance with Professor Clark's help. Medicaid, managed care. Can you start us slowly here and explain how these two concepts fit together and what they are? And how the idea of Medicaid and managed care sort of relates to the Medicaid landscape, the sort of the waivers like Indiana got with its HIP 2.0, and the way that sort of Medicaid is sort of developing under the ACA expansion.
By way of reminder, Medicaid is the joint federal state program that is designed to provide health care financing for the poor, people of a lower economic status. Historically, it was created kind of for specific segments of the group. Many people see them kind of as having reflected what legislatures believed were the deserving poor, although that's not in any particular legislation. That's what's commonly understood. And so this was back in 1965. So this has existed and it's been expanded over time. Obviously, most recently through the Affordable Care Act go beyond those segments and to cover kind of all adults up to a federal poverty level of about 138% of federal poverty level. Managed care has kind of developed at the same time as a way both for private insurance plans, but also the government to try to contain costs. through managing care, through managing the particular payments for certain services. And so, quite frankly, over the last few decades, managed care has increasingly become an important vehicle for delivering care even to Medicaid enrollees. But certainly at this place, it's kind of the key tool for expanding coverage. And so we see this kind of one of the things that we've seen in states. Some states kind of utilize both. They utilize the older fee-for-service model and then use a managed care model for certain populations. But it really has been expanding quite a bit. For quite a while now in California, we've had a Medicaid managed care plan that we've used to deliver care to lots of Medicaid enrollees. And this plan has been actually seen as a way of innovating, not just containing cost, but we've seen a number of innovations in terms of, for example, wellness initiatives that reach out to members. Kind of one example is my favorite is a nutrition and Zumba series, because who doesn't love Zumba? Another initiative is that the plan here relies on its members to do peer counseling to other communities. This is very important in LA because of all of the kind of very diverse communities. So managed care has played a role in kind of a number of different ways for quite a while. The other thing that's happened is kind of as states try to experiment, again, California is an example of this, they've used managed care to try to figure out how to cover more people, but they may have wanted to not have to comply with all of the kind of strict requirements for the regular Medicaid. So what they could do is apply for what's called a Section 1115 waiver, kind of restructure Medicaid in ways to try to accomplish the same goals in a revenue-neutral way. So we see that a number of states have these waivers and have different kinds of models for their Medicaid managed care plans. And again, so many of kind of the innovations that are coming both from plans and states we see being used in these models. Another example is especially for populations that may have complex needs. And higher needs, so that may need long-term support services, that may kind of have kind of important behavioral healthcare needs as well as physical healthcare needs. There may be plans that are designed specifically to really try to help provide extra support for those populations. Another area where we see this being done is kind of for beneficiaries or enrollees who are considered dual eligible. It's called dual eligible. So they're Medicaid and Medicare beneficiaries. There's been a huge problem with the fragmentation of their care that's really gotten in the way of them accessing care in a timely manner. And so a number of states at the urging of CMS have are kind of using demonstration projects to better coordinate care for these individuals. In fact, just last week, I think New York launched its latest kind of reform of its fully integrated duals advantage program. This one specifically targeting individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So it's a type of managed care plan. It's a capitated model, but it is special in that it includes a benefit package tailored to support individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Another example from California, again, announced just last week, again, through an 1115 Medicaid waiver, CMS is allowing California for the first time to be able to use financial incentives to boost preventive care and also, to include social services such as housing assistance as part of its healthcare delivery system. So this is huge. I mean, this is something that advocates have been pushing for quite some time, and that's, kind of getting states and payers to recognize the importance of social determinants of health, meeting patients where they are, trying to address those other factors that really do impact not just their immediate health needs, but their long-term and recurring health needs. So this is a very exciting development.
That is terrific, Bree. I mean, that is really a wonderful overview of some of the more innovative aspects of Medicaid managed care and some of the fully integrated dual plans, the FIDA plans out in New York and in California. I'm wondering, and we've also heard from Jessica Mantle a few weeks ago about the innovations in the Affordable Care Act promoting this sort of community health or population health approach that could potentially fulfill the triple aim of increasing access, improving quality, and reducing cost. I am wondering, though, is there any counter narrative here? Are there any worries that essentially either through maladministration or, say, through just a general austerity mindset in some states, that these programs could be used to disguise cuts to benefits or to essentially, or they might be imposed on populations that are vulnerable who may not fully understand their rights and what they ought to be getting under these plans?
I absolutely think there is that concern. And so, you know, one of the things that is sad to me is that as I'm reading through kind of some of the problems that plans and states and CMS are trying to deal with today, I'm reminded that my very first major project as a law student intern over 15 years ago, I was at National Health Law Program, was precisely one of the issues I mentioned, which was dealing with the challenge of access barriers for people with special needs, especially people with developmental disabilities or chronic conditions in the first Medicaid managed care plans at that time. So this is an ongoing concern. You know, one of the things that I see in the more promising plans and examples of the more promising success stories is that there is real outreach within the community and partnership with other social service providers who are true advocates for the enrollees and are basically trusted institutions or trusted kinds of friends of the enrollees. And so, you know, kind of just as one example of that, there's a, in a couple of states, we've had plans reaching out to help children in foster care. And in one state, I believe Tennessee, those who recently aged out of foster care. Kind of one of the things that seems to make those plans kind of hopeful, you know, give us hope, is that they really are partnering with other social service agencies to try to make sure people are getting all the information they need. The other model that we see used with those foster care models and some of the other plans include kind of creating medical homes for individuals so that there is, again, somebody who is a healthcare person, right, on the front line who basically takes ownership of helping to guide the person through the healthcare system, navigate it, figure out how to navigate even different insurance systems, how to get access to specialists, how to get those other services. There are not lots of plans doing this yet. So there's a report by the Trade Association of Insurance Plans that came out in 2013. It gives nice examples of some of the more successful plans. And you know, one of the things that we we're seeing, I think early on, it says, you know, we still need to have kind of evaluations of the varying approaches that states are taking to figure out if, in fact, you know, they're achieving their goals in this context, in particular of kind of increasing the involvement of individuals in their care decision making, which is very important. And also making sure that they are able to live more independently. So these are two very important goals that really are wrapped up and are part of the quality and access aims you mentioned. And so, you know, one of the things, the early observations we're seeing is that there seems to be greater success at that with plans that actually have deep ties within the community and very strong partnerships with other kind of providers outside of the healthcare system in those communities. That should not be surprising. You know, where you have plans that don't have those ties, don't have those partnerships, move in and out of markets kind of without real regard to kind of how it impacts one's continuity of care, clearly this isn't going to work.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is that these managed care plans are essentially expansion agnostic. We're seeing these in both expansion states and non-expansion states. Is there a decent possibility that some of the coordination gains and cost control gains might push some states towards expansion? Or has that become such a politicized issue that that sort of rational progress isn't really behind that kind of move?
I'm a bit more hopeful. I think there is really actually a disconnect between the political rhetoric around expansion and, you know, kind of what people term as Obamacare, because, of course, you know, politically, we know Republicans cannot be for Obamacare. But the Medicaid expansion is actually something that there are a good number of Republicans who actually realize the benefits of it and the financial benefits of it. And so I think they were realizing that already. I mean, we actually do see this when we look at the numbers of states that have expanded. Again, it's there. Parts of it are definitely still politicized, but I don't think it's as stark as the rhetoric would have us believe. You know, whether or not managed care helps, it's really going to depend on what we learn over the next couple of years, because states are very concerned, even those who've expanded. There's a concern that this expansion is going to lead to costs, right? So states are going to have to start taking up more of this cost for the expansion population in the next few years. And so we do see, you know, reports that states are concerned about that additional cost. And so they're going to be looking very closely at whether or not these innovations are really helping to curb some of those costs. And I think, you know, there are some people who are seeing some good news so far, which we can talk about if you're interested, from surveys of kind of state Medicaid directors. Managed care could certainly help that.
Got it. Well, that does help a lot. And I'm hoping that we can, perhaps now, perhaps a little later in the podcast, get also into this tension between, say, maintenance of effort and the ability of a Medicaid system to offer care at the level that's, say, offered to people generally in the state, versus, you know, the concerns about costs that would probably lead to ever lower payments for providers and others. But for now, I'm wondering if we could just look at the Kentucky situation, because it appears that the Tea Party candidate, Matt Bevin, went around the state really blasting Obamacare, blasting in part the Medicaid expansion. And then I heard in some recent reports that he would permit the people, 400,000 or so or 500,000 or so people that had signed up, to keep their Medicaid, but then wouldn't allow others on. But yet they also have to wait at least a year to close down that aspect of the exchange. So I'm wondering, Bree, if you might have any commentary on the sort of the overall messiness that, say, politics are going to be causing as we have this, I guess, a new kind of state. We used to have expansion states and non-expansion states, and now we have like a half expansion state, or a state that has old expandees but won't have new ones or something. So, and any thoughts on Kentucky?
And just to add to the messiness, to get back to Nick's point, you have people who are expanding, or states expanding, by creating their own kind of special expansion, right? Through CMS waivers. So I guess to answer first the question about Kentucky, I mean, this is the perfect example of the disconnect between the politicization of kind of Obamacare versus kind of smart policy decision making and practical policy decision making by legislators when it comes to getting federal support for private or public insurance expansion. Because when you put it the way I just put it on the latter, you know, kind of example, people are for that and they want that. And so that's part of what we see, I think, personally going on in Kentucky. So it was very easy to make kind of sensational statements like no Obamacare in Kentucky and kind of make claims that call it unaffordable. But as you said, it's a very different thing when the governor is forced with a decision that has kind of serious political, practical, and financial implications. So, you know, for example, he said he does not want people to have to lose their insurance, right? And so so clearly he's not going to try to undo the expansion. That's been made clear. So he wants to keep part of Obamacare. But what he has said, and you alluded to this, is perhaps there's some sort of model of an expansion that we could come up with in Kentucky that reflects our values and the values he talks about of personal responsibility, making sure people have skin in the game. Something that is not kind of exactly what was contemplated in the ACA. And other states have done this. And he actually points to Indiana as a model. And so the good news is, again, this means, you know, he's not saying people will lose insurance. At least he won't kick them off insurance. Exactly. But people are very concerned about this because, you know, this kind of, at least if you look at Indiana's model, it's one that kind of adds additional requirements not contemplated by the ACA and requirements that could actually make it harder for people to access care. So I just want to kind of give a shout out to Sydney Watson at St. Louis University because she's been doing work on this. And so I know she has lots of concerns about some of the waivers that have been issued by CMS and whether or not they are actually even authorized under the ACA. But, you know, Indiana, for example, you know, wants to kind of require certain beneficiaries above a certain income level to pay premiums or to increase the cost sharing. And so this is going to have an impact. It wants to have kind of less generous benefit levels, benefit packages for certain beneficiaries. Again, that's going to impact access. You know, one of the things that CMS rejected, you know, Indiana wanted a work referral requirement. So that was rejected. But that just gives you a sense of some of the changes that, you know, perhaps Bevin will ultimately ask for. And that can have an impact and that it looks like CMS is willing to entertain. Matter of fact, Montana, I think, just announced a waiver that it got that it kind of allows the state to kind of use some of those same kinds of requirements. So, you know, that's the piece of it that's scary. You know, with the health exchange piece, I know this goes a little beyond Medicaid, but, you know, that's another example where he says he wants to dismantle it and people would rely on the federal exchange. But again, as a practical matter, you know, he can't do it immediately. There are notice and coordination requirements he has to follow to transition people smoothly back to the federal exchange. And there are questions about how much money that it will take, not just to kind of undergo that dismantling and transition, but how much money he's going to need to pay back to the federal government. And then finally, you know, there are a lot of people in Kentucky. You know, Kentucky was the model, actually. I mean, it was a success story for its Connect Health Exchange. So I do think he needs to think seriously about whether he might be expending political capital that he doesn't want to hurt members of his state.
That is a very sad commentary in terms of the amount of pain that some governors seem to be willing to inflict on their own states in order to be ideologically pure. And it is pretty troubling to me, you know, going through even the NFIB versus Sebelius coercion ruling to consider just how little the states really have in how little skin in the game the states have in terms of this expansion population presently and, you know, even after 2020. I think looking at the Medicaid program as a whole, one of the things we wanted to talk about was the surge of enrollees and how that is being handled. I know that, you know, whenever a healthcare system massively expands insurance, there are sometimes concerns about growing pains and a lack of providers. Have you seen any of that, Bree, or do you think that there are ways in which the system seems to be managing this surge?
I do think the surge has created a few challenges. And so the first most obvious one probably is just the administrative burden of handling the applications. We've seen this in a number of places. Again, sadly, California was one place where we saw some initial problems with delays. Just recently, New Jersey reported that it had to use a private contractor to work through its backlog of Medicaid applications. And in both of these states, it's not just kind of applications for new enrollees. It actually impacts renewals and delays those, so much so that in California, this led to legal action. You know, there were other problems with enrollment delays caused by the challenge of transitioning data from the federal government to the states. The good news is that a lot of these problems have been fixed or improved. You know, states are increasing administrative capacity during peak times. Some states have been able to modernize their data systems where that was the problem. So I think those are growing pains, but there's growth. I think the second challenge that's we kind of touched on a bit earlier already is really this fear of the unexpected cost, right, that states are going to have to bear. Because the surge of enrollees was partly due to the expansion. And so there's fear about how much the state will have to start paying for that, going forward. But also with all of the education and publicity around reform, we saw many more people who were previously eligible also enrolling in Medicaid. And again, for those that they're subject to the traditional match, not the, almost 100% match by the federal government that the federal government gives for the expansion group. So you're definitely seeing kind of news reports about states being concerned about their deficit. Again, Bivin mentioned, kind of unaffordability in criticizing, Obamacare in the state. But there is this great survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation, which did a 50-state survey of Medicaid directors, and it helps present a more balanced picture. So absolutely it, reflects the kind of surge that you're talking about, and it talks about what those enrollment increases looked like. But it also noted in its survey that, like two-thirds of the Medicaid directors in the expansion states said that enrollee costs were at or below what they had expected. For the first time, Kaiser also asked the directors to really try to figure out if there were savings in other areas of government as a result of the healthcare reform expansion. And so several states reported savings in areas such as behavioral health spending and criminal justice spending as a result of the reforms. And then it's also important to remember that there is an increase of revenue coming in. And so that needs to be kind of taken into account when we're thinking about the costs of expansion and the surge in enrollment. And finally, some of the enrollment surges are clearly tied to the economy, and we've gone through some hard times. So we do see, many states saying they actually don't anticipate, kind of the increases that they've seen the last couple of years to continue at this rate. So, so that's the more balanced picture we have, at least with costs. But once again, the kinds of innovations that we talked about that both plans and states and CMS are really pushing, we're going to keep monitoring those to see if those are also helping to keep costs down. And it's probably worth noting at least a couple of states are looking at how to improve their state collection practices too. I would say that kind of the final challenge is one you mentioned as well, Frank, and that's the pressure on the existing providers and networks. So, for example, last year, Oregon, I think it was 4 months into their expansion, two of the managed care plans in Oregon had to close to new enrollment because of the high numbers of new patients that they had. Some plans, again, are using innovation, using different models to try to deal with the surge. So some plans are using patient-centered primary care homes and non-traditional healthcare workers to increase their primary care capacity. One plan had to kind of increase its payment rates, in fact, to try to attract more providers. But this really brings us to another very serious problem. And that is the fact that, prior to expansion, there was already a pretty serious access problem in many states because of low reimbursement rates. At least that's what it's been attributed to kind of by many surveys and providers. There have not been enough providers to serve the Medicaid patients, primary care providers or specialists.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Professor Clark for joining us today. Bree, it was great to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's twihl.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. Or remember, the holiday season is coming up, so buy our Twill t-shirts and exclaim your health geekiness to the whole world. Also, if you've got a moment, please go to iTunes and rate the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry, NicolasTerry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I can be found at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.